Good morning, everyone. You are a hearty bunch. How many were shoveling this morning? How many? Okay, good for you. I was shoveling. It's good. It's a wonderful thing, though. It's not minus 30. Let's look on the bright side. It's bright. Great to have you here this morning. Everyone breathe. Let's have a good morning. So I was chatting with a woman not long ago. She has young adult children, younger adult. She was telling me that one of her kids, her daughter, had just graduated with a law degree. She's working at a law firm downtown. She was so proud of her. I asked her about her son. She says, oh, he's traveling over in Southeast Asia somewhere, experiencing all kinds of cultures and people. She says, you couldn't make two different people out of my son and my daughter. They are yin and yang, so far apart. So anyways, we had a good chat about them. I said, are they dating? Like, are they married? Are they like love interests, whatever? And that's when she kind of stiffened up a little. She says, you know, that's a sensitive topic around our place right now. I said, oh, really? Tell me, what's that about? She says, oh, my daughter told me that she's moving in with her boyfriend. I said, oh. She said, yeah, you know, he really is a nice guy. He treats her like gold. But Jeff, we told her, we're not crazy about that arrangement. You know, you're starting off that relationship on the wrong foot. Living together? Living in sin? She didn't say that, but that's what she was saying. She said, at some point she said, you know, how can God bless their relationship when they're doing that? And I'm just wanting the best for her. She said, it just seems to be what so many kids are doing these days, and it's upsetting, but what can you do as a parent? I said, well, what about your son? She says, oh, he's not ready to settle down anytime soon. You know, I keep asking him, you know, is there someone? You know, I know he's seeing girls. And he knows it bothers me, she says. She said, you know, he jokes with me. She says, Mom, I swiped right last night. Which is a Tinder comment. And so she's just like, I don't know what to say, Jeff. I just don't know. You know, we were raised differently. And these kids, they just don't understand how much they're impacting their heart and their soul. Maybe you've heard those kinds of comments. Maybe you've made those kind of comments. Maybe you had your parents making those kind of comments. Maybe you were raised with them in some church circles. Within many church communities, sex outside of marriage, sex in general, has been understood as something kind of, unless it's in a very specific situation, it's kind of something sinister, something awkward, something dirty. But no matter what you think, it's not stopping people, right? It's not. It's like there are all these rules that were set up at some point by someone. These people might at some level believe them, but very few seem to be following them. Today we begin a new series about sex and sexuality at Friends Church called Know Thyself. This is kind of the second time we've kind of swung through this area in the last couple years. And we want to do this because we think there has to be a better way of approaching sex and sexuality. Many of you have kids, or maybe you're at a stage of life where you're just contemplating, what role does sex play in my life? Maybe you're single. Maybe you've been divorced. Maybe you have relatives, maybe you have friends, family, and they're walking through these things and you're just like, I don't know what to really make of this. And so you're just kind of moving along with the current. But maybe down deep, down at some level, you're wondering, is this okay? Is this right? We think there has to be a more informed way of going about dealing with our sexuality. And let's be honest, the church, gosh, the church has always been in the dark ages with this topic. I don't know about you, and I know that there are different variations in different church circles, but a predominant view within the church was that unless you were in a heterosexual, monogamous, married relationship, sexual activity of any kind needed to be avoided at all costs. It's sinful. It's dangerous. Sexual desire, pleasure, not good. Masturbation, evil. In some circles, it could give you acne. I mean, you've probably heard all kinds of different stories. I was reading about it. I was like, whoa, that was a crazy one. Premarital sex, come on, don't even think about it. And gosh, same sex? Are you kidding me? Which is fine, I suppose, as long as you're one of the lucky ones that are now in that, perhaps, that proper criteria. You've met all the criteria. Well, then you're good. Then you're like, we're fine. But if you don't, if you're divorced, if you've never been married, maybe have no plans of being married, maybe you're gay, maybe your sexual life doesn't fit somehow the criteria in a certain way, does this mean that you're running spiritually adrift? Are you pissing off God in some way? Is your life going to hit the rocks? Is this going to affect you? Is it going to hurt your spirit or your soul? Is this mum believed? Is God or the universe or the more than or whatever out there, are they going to see to it that you're punished or that your life doesn't go well because you're living somehow in sin? Is that how it works? Like, where do these kinds of beliefs and understandings come from? Is it God who said these kinds of things? Or does the Bible say these kinds of things? I think there are many who aren't sure. They don't necessarily know whether these views or beliefs are legit or not. And it may not be enough to keep you from exploring your sexuality, but in the back of your mind or souls, maybe perhaps you wonder. Maybe for some it causes a low level of anxiety because you're doing something that maybe at one point in your life someone told you. Perhaps it's creating a relational stress or conflict somewhere in your family or you're watching it. Maybe it's even causing some kind of disconnection in your own spiritual journey because you do believe, maybe down deep, God's looking at you with a lot of shame and disappointment. If we're going to move forward, find a healthier version of ourselves, I think one that is more authentic and real and deeply spiritual, we got to chase this thing down, don't we? We got to figure out, where did these beliefs come from? Are they legit? And if they are, then maybe we need to really think hard about what we're doing. Maybe we need to realign. But if they're not legit, then I think we need to be on the lookout for a new sexual ethic. I was listening to a podcast recently. It was on a topic, this topic. It was one by The Liturgists. I don't know if you've ever heard about The Liturgists, but I got to tell you, it's a great podcast. If you enjoy what we do here, if you like kind of the stuff that we talk about, this, you'll love the stuff they explore and the way they do it. Pretty irreverent. They break the rules on so many different fronts. If you're coming from more of a traditional background, it might make you a little uneasy at times. But man, I tell you, they look hard at why we believe and the intersection of faith and art and science in a great way. Anyways, listening to a podcast, Michael Gunger, the host, led his listeners through what I thought was a helpful philosophical exercise. And it's simply by asking the question, how do we decide what is right and wrong? Really, how do you decide? What metric do we use to decide that this action is right or this action is wrong? This kind of sex, bad. This kind of sex, okay. This is all right, that's bad. Let's just take murder for a second. Killing. Why do we think murder is wrong? Well, some would say, well, the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Okay. The fact that you're alive means that you're killing things every day. You wash your hands, you're killing things. You eat food, meat, you're killing things. When people go, oh, come on. That wasn't what that was talking about. It's talking about people. Okay. So then what about war? What about the police? We hire police to protect, and sometimes they've killed someone. What about that? What if someone breaks into your house, threatens to kill your family? Is killing in self-defense any different than the kind of killing a serial killer would do? Well, you say, of course. Of course. That's not even the same thing. You're right. I would agree with you. But who makes these decisions? How do you nuance this out? Because the Bible just says, thou shalt not kill. Someone is looking at that and going, well, come on, let's reason this out. Someone is coming along and nuancing that, right? They're going, well, it's not this, maybe it's this. Maybe it's not this, but it's this. How do we decide what expressions of sexuality are okay and which aren't? Some would say, well, I think the Bible makes it pretty clear. I get driven nuts when someone says, the Bible pretty clearly says it, Jeff. I go, oh, really? Huh. Well, let's just go there, can we? I can't wait to have you show me which part of the Bible makes our sexuality, our sexual ethics, so clear and clean. Don't get me wrong. There are passages that warn against unhealthy sexual practice. Thou shalt not fornicate. Fornication. Well, is fornication sex outside of marriage in a consensual, healthy way? Or are we talking about young boy prostitutes that sat outside the temples in that time, in that day, and it was practice for people to be able to use and abuse as they would? Which kind of fornication are we referring to? Fornication has a pretty broad bandwidth here. Doesn't really narrow it down real well. To add to these complications in the Bible, there is some extremely sexual language. Allow me. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. This is from Song of Songs. Song of Songs, an erotic poem that revels in desire. Desire that is postponed and then fulfilled and then postponed again. I come to my garden. Oh, it says, I come to my garden, the woman's lover proclaims. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. Open to me, my love, my dove, my perfect one. He pleads, using a double entendre that few could miss. My beloved thrust his hand into the opening. The woman responds, and my inmost being yearned for him. But then he withdraws, and so she laments. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and was gone. We're talking, I could really get into some crazy. We're talking vivid sexual language between two lovers. It's not talking, oh, this guy was married, and this girl was married. And no, it's talking about two lovers in love and their sexual expression. And of course, there's the story of Ruth who seduces Boaz, uncovering his feet. You may not know this. That's a Hebrew euphemism for uncovering a man's genitals. Didn't you learn something cool this morning? Ruth seduces Boaz. They're not married. They have sex. And in doing so, Ruth gains a home. And secures a future for her mother-in-law and her. And in the Bible, Ruth is held up as this hero. She's praised for her actions. What about the love of Jonathan toward David, a friendship so strong that Jonathan came to love David more than he loved women? And then there's David, who spies out that beautiful Bathsheba bathing on a rooftop. He invites her for a sexual rendezvous in the palace. And even though he already had many wives, I want that one too, he says. Child of their adultery dies, but you know what? Bathsheba later gives birth to Solomon. Solomon is the famous king who actually wrote Song of Songs that I was just quoting you from. Seems to me things worked out okay. In these biblical passages, sexual longing and expression, it refuses to be limited to the love between a husband and a wife, or even between a man and a woman. Shoot, and why stop at one? In Genesis, polygamy is considered normal. It's what men did. The patriarchs, they had multiple wives. They had slave wives. The 12 sons of Jacob that led the 12 tribes of Israel, they were all fathered by multiple wives and concubines. But maybe you shouldn't have sex at all. Because there's a passage, this passage in Matthew, where Jesus tells the disciples that some people live like eunuchs. Don't have testicles. They've been castrated. They don't get involved sexually. And you know what? That's okay, he says. Be okay with that. Some early Christians heard this as Jesus recommending celibacy. So there's whole movements that have said, no. Men aren't supposed to be having sex. In fact, back in the early church, there was a whole movement where men were castrating themselves because they believed it was what real spiritual men did. A guy named Origen, I'll quote in a second. He was one of the guys who wrote much of our doctrine. He was instrumental in the Christian doctrine. This is why when someone says, well, the Bible clearly points out one way that sexuality is to be experienced by all humans, I get a little suspicious. He or she is either extremely ignorant of all that the Bible says on the topic, or they have some kind of agenda to sell. If you look honestly at what the Bible offers for an example of human sexuality, you'll find it is diverse. So if the Bible isn't really clear in terms of guidance for our sexual lives, if it's not like pinpointed, here's the one law for everyone at all times and all places, where do we get our sexual ethic? Where do we determine what is right and wrong? If you really do your homework, you'll realize that our sexual ethic that you operate in right now is pretty much the product of your cultural context, where you grew up, who you grew up around, what authorities spoke on the topic that you listened to. I mean, I was raised in a family in a church environment that essentially saw, let's just take drinking, for example, as something very dangerous. I grew up in a dry family, dry household, dry relatives, man. We had Christmas dinners, Super Bowl parties. No one is cracking beers. No one is drinking wine at the big family dinners. It just wasn't happening. There was not that someone was coming out and saying, this is terrible, this is absolute evil. No one was saying that, but they'd say, oh yeah, you know what, how much alcohol kills brain cells, kid. I remember hearing that as I was young. I was like, wow, these people must be pretty stupid. I'm watching a lot of people drinking. Or you don't have to be drinking to have a good time, Jeff. You're right, don't. I remember going, and this messaging getting so drilled into me at a young age that I remember going over to my next door neighbors. They were throwing a big party. I was just playing with my buddy, but you know, his family had friends and family over. They were drinking, and I saw on the kitchen counter all this booze, and my heart started to race. I was just like, this is not good. What are they doing? I remember at a young age, I didn't want to even stay. I wanted to leave. It made me so nervous. Why? I was surrounded in a cultural context that said, don't be doing this. This is the way it is of sex. Been surrounded by certain messaging. Now, maybe you come from a family, very progressive. Maybe your parents were, from a very young age, talking about sex in a real open, honest way. Maybe they were telling you about their exploits when they were kids, all the crazy stuff. Maybe they're talking to you about safe sex. I remember guys in high school, they pull out their wallet and they'd show me a couple condoms their dad had given them that weekend. They said, hey, look it. I know you're going out in this volleyball tournament. Be smart. And they'd give them a whole bunch of other advice. And I'd be sitting there going, your dad told you that. That was not the advice I was given. Just like alcohol, man, sex was something that was dangerous, bad, man, steer away. My parents never talked to me about sex. It was just one of those forbidden zones. Something comes up on the TV, all of a sudden a sexual thing, my mom's reaching for the remote, click. Indirectly, that has a way of communicating something, doesn't it? My mom would roll her eyes. Oh, that's disgusting. Whether you grew up in a religious family or not, though, and I've talked to psychologists about this, to say, is it the Christians that are all screwed up sexually? Like, are we the damaged goods and not? And they're quick to say, you know what? Oh, there's a lot of baggage within the Christian communities, but the baggage is on both sides. It don't matter whether you grew up in a religious family or not. Chances are, this topic was not really well skillfully handled. Chances are good. Maybe you're one of the few. You know what? You are lucky. You are so lucky. Most never talked about sex at home. Most of the time it was awkward and avoided. Girls were told to wear more clothes. They were warned that the boys were out for one thing. Sexuality was quickly dismissed as disgusting. Why? What was influencing that kind of reaction? I've shared this before, but the early church fathers, they wanted nothing to do with sex. Tertullian said, I prefer the extinction of humankind over the evils of sexual intercourse. You know, I talked about Origen earlier. Martin Luther, the King Daddy of the Protestant Reformation, this guy, he has had a huge impact. Have you ever known someone who's Lutheran? Martin Luther was at the start of this. He said, intercourse is never without sin. These are men who put the heavy fingerprint, their fingerprints on Christianity. You say, well, why were they so anti-sex? It was their culture. Many experts who have looked at this and going, where is this coming from? Whether it was the dualism of Plato, the Stoic philosophy of the early Greco-Roman culture, Gnosticism. These are all popular philosophies that were rampant in the early centuries. And they were shaping a large part of the leadership within the church. And that was way back then. And I think that still has trickling effects into different pockets. But there have been more recent cultural developments that I think have put their fingerprint on our response to sex. In the 60s, the invention of the pill, birth control, the sexual revolution that swept through the Western world, all over the world. I mean, everyone was encouraging people, make love, not war, right? Sex was everywhere in the 60s. But the church saw this as just this huge threat to everything going on. And so they started mounting a counterattack. It didn't really get traction until the early 90s. When a huge campaign was launched challenging kids to be abstinent before marriage. How many have ever heard of the purity movement, purity culture? This was big in certain circles. Down the States, massive. I was a youth pastor at the time, and I heard about this True Love Waits campaign. It was taking the church world by storm. School, youth group campaigns, based on these conservative Christian values, it challenged kids to make a pledge. Believing that true love waits, This pledge says, I make a commitment to God, myself, my family, my friends, my future mate, my future children to be sexually abstinent from this day until the day I enter into a biblical marriage relationship. If you're sitting here going, I never heard about this. Well, let me tell you something. Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake signed the pledge. It was big. It was all over culture. Not only did they pledge to abstain from sex, but sexual thoughts, sexual touching, pornography. I mean, any actions that could lead to sexual arousal. That was the real danger, sexual arousal. Bounce your eyes away from anything that's tempting you. They had all kinds of different things. Challenging people. By the late 90s, man, this thing got steam. Big Christian rock bands that were huge at the time, traveling with these campaign leaders. In every school promoting this thing, the Roman Catholic Church jumped on. The Assemblies of God, every large church denomination was all about this because this was the way they were going to save their kids from the dangers of sex. Because the movement went so mainstream, the cover was that, hey, we're trying to protect kids from STDs and unwanted pregnancy. Oh, we're not going to tell them about safe sex. That's evil. We're going to tell them that the only answer is abstinence. But really, the main focus of this whole campaign, the purpose of remaining, was remaining pure in the eyes of God. This wasn't just a good or a moral choice. This was the choice that God wanted. Now, the effects of this long-term were massive. It petered out by about 2004. But by that point, it had left a whole generation of kids thinking something was inherently dirty or bad. Most kids later admit, oh, I blew that pledge off in a couple weeks. I had the purity ring. My parents would look at me like, oh, love you. I'm so proud of you. But they were living a lie. And not only were they engaging in different stuff, of course, they're sexual beings surrounded by sexual images. Kids want to do this stuff. And so what do? It drives them underground, makes them a liar to people that they love. Deep down inside, they think God is pissed. You're damaged goods. So even long after this whole thing has come and gone, these kids are getting married now. This generation is now getting married, and there's dysfunction in the marriage. Because how do you go from this thing that was so bad? I'm broken. I am no longer pure. I am impure. And now they start stepping into this relationship where now all of a sudden it's supposed to be okay. Most couldn't make that conversion. Psychologists have made lots of money off of that purity movement. Sexual repression just doesn't seem to work. That would be one observation that I've made of this. Creates all kinds of weirdness, doesn't it? It's like the Garden of Eden. Whatever you do, don't touch that tree. Whatever you do, don't. I can't help myself. It's like when I heard that bread was bad carbs. All of a sudden, I'd never thought about bread before, but now I love bread. It's like, there's something about the human psychology. You say you can't. I want it now. Bring it. Something scary happens when we're told to deny the very natural sexual wiring that exists within. It may work short term. Long term, you try to bottle up that sexual energy. That desired scary stuff begins to form. And let's just say, you don't have to look very far in the headlines to find the damage that's happened within certain church denominations where men have been refused, denied the ability. Not only that, but the sexual shame that came with this. You're no longer a virgin. Does that mean you're no longer pure? Are you damaged goods? Has your value been diminished in the eyes of God and others? Remember the day when JT, Justin Timberlake, came out and admitted that they had broken the pledge. Britney didn't know he had done that. And it was kind of like all of a sudden she's in the headlines going, you know, interviewed going, hey, Justin just said, you guys. You go back and you Google that. It's crazy. The shame, the public scorn from the religious community. She was our sweetheart. Now she's a whore. Problem of our unexamined ethic that comes from movements like this is that it's creating casualties, unconsciously contributing to guilt, shame, all kinds of mixed emotions around this thing. You know, I'm married. I'll be very honest with you. I was drinking this Kool-Aid when I was young. I never had sex before marriage. Kathy's the only woman I've ever slept with. It's weird. I almost feel kind of like embarrassed by that. I'm like, wow. At one time I was like, that was my badge. I was like, yeah, kids, come on, just follow me. Remember conversations I had with Kathy when I was asking her when we were dating and the shame that I did. She began to open up about her own life. I was like, you're kidding me. So here I am. We're married 28 years. Do I have to think about sexual ethic? No. But my boys, all of a sudden, they're hitting this age. And they're swiping right. And they're doing all that stuff. And I'm like, oh my God. And all this old messaging is bullshit in my mind. Well, it might have worked for a few. But I'm telling you, we are living in a different day and age. We need a different sexual ethic. We need one that doesn't have parents burying their head in the ground. Some of you got kids that are coming of age. You're listening very carefully. I know you are. We need a different sexual ethic. Some of the conversations that we're having with our boys over the last number of years have been really interesting. Where it's just like I've had to just take all my scripts and just put them aside. Here's some of the questions that we've just been asking. Are you hurting somebody? Are you using somebody? Am I numbing? Are you numbing your experiences, pain? What's behind this? Are you avoiding something? Are you using sex to distract? Is this just a numbing out thing? Has this ever been about boredom? Where you just think, oh, what else can I have tonight? Not realizing there's another very real person on the other end. Do I feel alone? So I'm acting in a way sexually that helps me feel less alone, but doesn't actually honor the experience or the identity of the other person. These questions are terrifying when you come from the school that I've been a part of. But I'm realizing as we begin to talk about this kind of stuff, the way that they begin to interact with this thing, it's not sex is bad. No, sex is amazing. Hey, it's great. It's great in a healthy way. So let's talk about what healthy looks like. I'm done. Here's the thing. I want to have a do-over with that mom who is so disappointed with her kids. Because I got to say, why don't you have these kind of questions? You say this guy is treating her like gold. Do you know how many kids from our generation raced into marriage only to beat each other up? abuse each other. There was no love in those relationships, but thank God they were married because sex and everything else is fine and they should be just fine. No. Does this make sense to you? If I started engaging in this kind of topic about 7 years ago, I had a whole crew of people just walk out of the church, left the church. They said, "You are dangerous. I do not want my kids hearing anything remotely close to what you're saying." It's just like, okay. Times, they are changing. I think down deep, what we all want for ourselves, for our kids, for this next generation, is for them to be in meaningful relationships. Consensual, satisfying, loving, meaningful relationships, if they so want that. With their safety, deep respect. How do we get there? It has something to do with how we decide what is right and wrong. And all I would say to you who are in the middle of trying to define a new sexual ethic is be open. And the chances of anyone arriving at one universal sexual ethic that we believe is right for everyone, I'm calling bullshit to that. Are you open to the fact that your sexual ethic might be different than the person beside you? Oh, I hope I gave you lots to just wrestle with today. I hope, and some are going to be mad. Write me, please. We need to keep this conversation going. For the next 3 weeks, we're going to talk about different parts of this sexual ethic. And I pray you will be open-minded. You will look back at your own experiences and not just look at from today forward. Most of you have forgotten what you were like when you were a kid. That's a problem, too. All right. May we be a community that doesn't stop, that tirelessly wades into deep, dark, scary water to find a way of loving our neighbor, loving our partner in the most God-honoring way. May this whole anti-sex sentiment die out. May we never propagate that. May we stop confusing our kids. And may the conversation just get bigger and wider. Yeah, that's my prayer for you. It's my prayer for me. All right, we're over. Have a great day. Keep shoveling. We'll see you next week, part 2 for Know Thyself.